Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 333 for May 27th of 2016. Google, Gentex, and Transflective Mirrors. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Well, Mr. V, you find yourself back in the studio.
It's been a long time. I was thinking about that. So last week I was in San Francisco driving the CX-9, so I wasn't here. And then at the week before that, we did the Ridgeline.
We were in the Ridgeline out in Texas. Was that 2 weeks ago? Really? Is that I don't remember.
Yeah, but it's been a long time. So, yeah. But I did find my way back. So
good.
I'm looking forward to a great show.
It will be a good one. Part of the reason we have Mark Phelan from the Detroit Free Press joining us right now, too.
Thank you, John. Good to be with you.
And we also have to mention he is our president of the North American Car and Truck of the Year jury, so we'll have to talk a little bit about that maybe later, too.
Look forward to it. Thank you.
But what we really want you to know is our special guest for today is Neil Bohm. He's the vice president of engineering at a company, if you haven't heard of it before, called Gentex, which absolutely dominates the mirror market. Isn't that right, Neil?
We have a dominant market share. That's correct.
So welcome to the show. Well, great to have you here.
Yeah, glad to be here. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, I mean, there aren't a whole lot of supplier companies that make mirrors in the world, are there?
No, there's not. And we do auto-dimming mirrors, so there's really only...
You guys sort of invented that, right?
We did, yep. And we've been in business for 40-plus years, and we produce many millions of them every year.
And you're based in Michigan over on the West Coast?
Yep, we're based in Zeeland, Michigan, and actually we do all of our manufacturing in West Michigan as well. So we do electrical assembly, microelectronics, all in West Michigan.
You're kidding. You don't make it all in China?
We do not.
Wow, that's unusual these days.
It's great from an engineering perspective as well. It's a toy store, right? You can build what you want to do.
Years ago, going over there, and these guys really have lean processes in place. And, I mean, it's just like their manufacturing. They probably couldn't do it any less expensively or certainly not any better anywhere else in the world than what you're doing there. And
philosophy is automation, is automate as much as you can, keep the labor down, but continue to add the labor to expand as volume increases.
Very interesting. But the reason we got you in here today is you guys have come up with an entirely new type of interior rearview mirror. And you've got an example of it next to you. But
right.
But lay the groundwork here. Where did you guys even come up with this idea?
Well, we've been in displays in mirrors for many years. We started with some backup cameras back in 2006. We did a go into reverse. The mirror would actually show the backup video of the backup camera. So we've been doing displays for many years in that function. And as we started working with General Motors at the time, we were working on this on the side of, why just have a backup camera? Vehicles are changing. Back structure of vehicles are getting smaller. Passengers occupy more space in the back. Why not have a function that allows you to see the visibility and greater visibility behind you, even though you have passengers blocking your mirror view? So what we came up with was the full display mirror product. And that's what this is demonstrating today, is this is in video mode right now. And with the simple flip of a switch, it goes back to our standard auto-dimming technology.
Now, in this demonstration that we're showing here, it's not as obvious that you go from the video feed to just a reflection of a mirror.
Correct.
But just so anybody watching right now goes, hey, wait, it looks like the mirror just went blank. No,
right.
It would actually be...
It's actually just an optical mirror.
It's an optical mirror.
And you project the images from the video camera onto it.
There's actually
there's
an LCD or display behind the glass. So Gentex does a lot of different unique things in West Michigan. We do microelectronics, electronic assembly. We also do our own glass coatings.
Really?
And our own chemistry as well. So we do all of that in a vertical integration in Zeeland. So with this, we're able to do different coatings that allow the display to be seen and visible, and then go back to a mirror mode that's still FMVSS compliant. And that's the priority for us, is it's got to be a safe product.
So you're basically
No, I was just going to say, so you're basically projecting a television image onto something that is also a mirror. If you had it in your house, you know, you'd walk past it, it'd be a mirror at one point, you'd turn it on, the Red Wings would be playing on it 5 minutes later.
That's absolutely it. Yeah, we call it transflective is the technology. That's our reference, but it's exactly that. It's kind of a one-way mirror of, say.
Transflective.
Transflective.
Okay, that's a new one for my vocabulary.
We're a bunch of engineers. We're not really creative in names, so that's all right. But that's absolutely what it does, is the display shines through the coatings. You turn the display off. It's now just a reflective surface.
Someone gets in the car, car's stopped, right?
Correct.
Looks like a normal mirror.
Looks like a normal mirror.
Start the car, put it in reverse, and that works, or?
It's actually on all the time. So what you do is, if you were to go in and get in the car, I've got my vehicle outside, we go sit in it, the first thing I'd have you do is have it in mirror mode and adjust it so that the mirror is in the usable position, and then by flipping that lever up, it then goes to display mode where the camera is located rear of the vehicle to give you that broader field of view as well as the clear, unobstructed field of view of what's behind you.
And what we're looking at here is a wider view than you would have if you were looking at it in mirror mode. Right. And there's no, you know, pillars for the inside of the car. There's no headrests, you know, right. Any of that stuff.
Correct, yep. And again, depending on the implementation of the camera, some cameras are going to be located on the rear near the license plate area, like on the CT6. There are other implementations where you can put them in a shark fin antenna on the roof of a sedan. That's a great location.
Mm-hmm.
Or inside the back window on a sport utility. So try to utilize the hardest part with cameras on the exterior is keeping them clean. We live in Michigan. Driving down the roads in the middle of winter, you're always wiping your backup camera off. In this situation, if you can keep it in an existing wiper pattern or where you get a good airflow, it actually creates a great spot.
Great point.
Is the expectation that someone would drive with that on all the time, or is it a situation where you'd go back and forth?
So I've been driving it for about 4 years, and I leave it on 99% of the time. My wife, on the other hand, when she drives, the kids are usually in the back, and she actually goes back and forth because she wants to see the kids when she's talking to them. So what we found in the last 4 years is you've got very different use cases on how mirrors are actually used. They're not just for viewing what's behind you. They're actually looking interior as well.
Mm-hmm. I found, because I've had the chance to drive this in both a prototype of the Chevrolet Bolt electric car and in the Cadillac XT5. In the XT5 out on the road, I found that it started to throw me off a bit because it changes two things. Number one, it changes your focal plane. So if you're looking at the reflective rear view mirrors out on the doors and then glance to the interior rear view mirror with the video feed, your focal plane has to change.
Right.
And the aspect ratio changes too. So the image does not look squished, but it's not the same aspect ratio as in the others.
Right.
And in situations where I'm looking at the mirrors a lot, I found myself turning off the video and just going to a regular mirror.
Right.
Are you getting that kind of feedback from people, too?
They're absolutely. One of the big ones is that aspect ratio or the size of objects. So as you look today, it's just the, take the Cadillac, for example. It's about an 80-degree field of view, whereas normal mirror is approximately 20. It's a little more than that, but approximately. So you're getting four times greater field of view, but the objects also are smaller in that field of view. So you're now taking something that's behind you, and it looks 10 times further behind or 5 times further behind just because the size of the object as you're compressing it. It does take a little bit to get used to. The one area that as we look forward and advances is how do you give the driver a better perception or understanding of where those objects are. Since you don't see the A-pillars, you don't see the back part of your vehicle because of where the D-pillars. Since you're not seeing the pillars, how do you help the consumer that's looking at the display understand where that vehicle is relative to them.
Oh, interesting. Right.
So there are some areas that we're working on as the technology progresses that we'll be advancing on in the coming years.
Many cars now have backup cameras, and they have lines indicating, you know, yellow lines, green lines, and then red lines. is that something that you're thinking about in terms of this to put?
That's one piece that we'll be
we're
playing with. I think we'd like to try to take it even further than that. I think that can create some confusion as well. People then focus too much on the depth of what they're. they try to read what's on a display instead of looking and getting the information quickly. And what we don't want is for them to be staring at it. That's not the intent. It's to take the field of view of your mirror, replace it with an unobstructed view of what's behind you in trying to replace that mirror view that you no longer have.
And it's in production right now on the Cadillac CT6 and the XT5,
correct.
Right? And I drove a long way in a CT6 earlier this year, and it was equipped with it, and I really liked it a lot. I didn't realize, I didn't figure out why the vehicles looked smaller until you explained that. That was very helpful. And I don't remember using it when I was backing up, because I think there was a display in the center console of the CT6. So are all of them set up to also be backup cameras, and I just didn't happen to look at the right time?
No, actually, no. For production vehicles, right now all the production vehicles that we have are going forward with two camera systems, one that's dedicated for backup and one that's dedicated for the rear vision, because you're looking at two different, from a product side, you're looking at two different functions. The mandatory backup camera is looking down and wide what's behind the vehicle, where with this rear vision system, we're trying to be narrower field of view and also looking more horizontal so that you're trying to replace that mirror image in those situations where you're obstructed.
Yeah. And it really is hard. I was driving from California back to Detroit, so there were some wide open spaces involved. And it really is amazing the breadth, the width of the field of vision that you get.
Right.
And I ended up using it probably 90% of the time during the day. At night, I found that the glare from headlights was exacerbated a little bit in the video display. Is that a common response, and are you working on that?
The hardest part with nighttime is the sensitivity of the camera system. So as we talk about it, there's the camera and the mirror, right, mirror and display. And getting the nighttime visibility is a really tough challenge.
And that's
without any type of illumination.
It wasn't so much glare, it was that the lights were bright and everything else was much darker, so I wasn't getting as much information in total.
And as much depth or contrast differences, right?
They're cheap little cameras.
I wouldn't go there, but we'll leave.
But I just did, right?
Yeah, exactly. But it is a challenge just from a nighttime exposure on the technology. And I think you'll see that that's one of the areas of focus as we go forward the next 5 years, is improving that vision at nighttime. From a display technology, we're doing everything we can to help there. We also do cameras as well, so we're active in that part of the business trying to find that best balance, that best solution to cover all scenarios.
You should have driven in reverse.
Yeah.
What was the question?
You should have driven in reverse.
Oh, backed up all the way
from Santa Monica.
And we do find that people use the mirror mode more at nighttime for that reason of because the objects are smaller in the display, because of the field of view. When you go back to the mirror mode, the objects are larger because you're back to your normal field of view that you're used to seeing.
And you've still got the auto-dimming mode, correct. If I remember correctly.
Correct. Yep, yeah. So we still have auto-dimming. So when you're back to mirror mode, the product functions like our normal auto-dimming mirrors today and drives the outside auto-dimming mirrors as well.
Okay.
Whose idea was this?
Actually, there was a small group of us that had it. And it's something we've been working on for many years. It's kind of as technology changes and, you know, you learn a lot over time on how to manage thermals. Because one of the challenges for us is this is a reflective surface. So you have to shine to get the brightness output that's required to see it really well. You have a lot of backlighting, and managing the thermals is a great engineering challenge. So over time, LEDs got more efficient. It enables this type of technology to really grow.
And is there anybody else who is supplying this kind of technology right now, or is Gentex, you know, you're the only game in town?
From production, we're the only ones in the market today.
Now, there's two more mirrors on the outside of the car. What are you going to do about them? Because there's huge payoffs in doing that, from visibility. The aerodynamicists would love to get rid of those mirrors. Right. There's wind noise associated with them. This has got to be a golden opportunity.
That's right. I mean, for us, again, we do mirrors and we do cameras. And so we're looking at ways to leverage that as we go forward into the market. We think that transition of conventional mirrors to display only using camera, for the same discussion we just had, it's going to take time. It's technically not a challenge. It's a consumer feedback issue that I think we'll see. What we're excited about with this is you have the choice to go back to a mirror.
And that lets you avoid regulatory hassles because it is still a mirror. It just has another function, right?
That's right. It's a compliant mirror. And there was feedback from this on the GM situation with Cadillac that they approved or stated that it was an acceptable technology.
But, okay, you say there might be some consumer, you know, pushback. Have consumers even been exposed to having no outside rear view mirrors and having display screens instead inside the car?
I think there's lots of studies that have been going on. Europe market as well as in North America, there's been consumer feedback. What I would say is if there are 4 years of utilizing this product and getting feedback on how people compare the displayed image to a normal mirror image, it's not everybody will appreciate the display. It's challenging. Or some of the issues we just talked about, the focal length issue is different.
But I would expect if all three mirrors had the same focal point, the same aspect ratio, the issues that I raised would go away.
It would help some, but you also have how people focus on them. And that's what we've observed, too. When you get somebody new into a car that's got a display, they don't use it like they were their mirror, where you look and you look back. They're focusing on it, and then they're trying to come back to what's going on. Gotcha. And where am I at. That's what we've observed in our own studies.
Well, and have your studies given you any ideas about, for side view mirrors, if you went to a display screen, what's a good place to put them in the car? I mean, would you just put them on the inside in the mirror so people are still sort of instinctively glancing in the same directions, or are you thinking about other locations?
So we actually are setting up some vehicles to do more of those studies right now. From some of the regulatory items that are occurring in Europe, right now the driver's side has to be on the center or to the left of the driver.
Good.
So otherwise, if you start moving that driver's side camera to the center line of the vehicle, looking this way when you have the vehicle on your side, just it's not intuitive. So it's a very heavy HMI ergonomics evaluation that's occurring and the industry's been working on.
Are you finding younger drivers are more adaptable to this versus those of us who have been driving for...
You know, not that much right now. I think when we look out, my kids are 12 and 10, and I think when they're in their 20s, I think that'll be a very different and a shift in the market. I believe that.
Because they're used to dealing with... The expectation of seeing...
Seeing displays, technology, games, and you think of, you know, they don't know what a bag phone was or a rotary dial phone, and go back in history, they don't know the evolution, they just know a cell phone. Hmm. So I do believe that's a progression that will occur. That they'll get more used to it, and by that time the technology will evolve, where we'll be in a good position for that.
Well, and just physically, for you know younger drivers and people who don't have any kind of prescription lens, it's easier to use the different focal length.
That's right.
Distance of the camera, because you know with a mirror, it's just like looking at a mirror. You can be using the long lens in your glasses, and it looks fine. But
right.
You need to sort of use the lower part of your glass if you have a sort of multiple prescription, right?
Right, correct. Yes, and that is an area when we talk about that future evolution. This technology, it's moving very rapidly. So before the first generation was in production, the second was evolving, and the third is in process. And so we're continuing to evolve the technology to get rid of some of those challenges that you run into.
So you think you can make that less of an adjustment for people?
We have a lot of research in that area to figure out how that would make sense. And there's certain display technologies that can help, but how to overcome it when you have some drivers in the vehicle that have that issue and others in that same vehicle that don't, how do you adapt? And so that's a little further out. There's a lot of research to be done in that area, but it is something we're active in.
This isn't Cadillacs now. Are you looking to bring this into lower parts of the market?
Absolutely. So Cadillac's first to market with it, and the Chevy Bolt as well. And then we'll be, within the next 12 to 18 months, we have three other OEMs that will come to market with it. So it's got a lot of interest. We're very fortunate with that. It's gravitated really well with their own clinics that they've performed. We're pretty excited to continue to move forward with it.
Well, it's one of those gee whiz articles, you know, in a car, you know, where you pull your friends or neighbors aside and say, hey, look at this, and that helps sell cars.
It absolutely does. And for driving it for 4 years, I absolutely love it. You get used to it, and it's a great technology.
This is a great story. Oh, sorry, you were going to say,
Mark? No, I was just going to say, I think I interrupted when you were talking about the side view mirrors. Is there a horizon for when you think those might be something that would be in production in Europe or here or elsewhere?
Well, I think there's going to be a gradual progression, and it's going to start in some high luxury vehicles. It's starting more as a styling theme is what we see. You know, and I've seen some numbers recently that talk about anywhere between 50 to 100,000 vehicles could have it by 2030. So it's not something that's going to move extremely fast, but it is something that'll start. And then once it gets moving, I think it'll start rolling out a little bit more broadly, but it's still going to take a significant time.
And this is moving pretty quickly, it sounds like.
This is moving very quickly. Yeah, the growth is, as we started again, we just did the XT5, right, the CT6, the Bolt, and then the three other OEMs will be coming on in the next 12 to 18 months. Pretty exciting.
And, you know, what I love about this story, and this is why I think our viewers tune into the show here, whoever figured so much science and research went into a mirror? You know, you're talking about the electronics, you're talking about the coatings, you're talking about handling the thermal issues, right. You're handling, you know, because to the general public, it's a mirror.
That's right. Right. It's a piece of glass and plastic. It's nothing. Technology's not there, but it's actually very exciting. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Real good. Well, Neil Bohm, thanks so much for coming on and showing us what, and what do you call the mirror?
We call it full display mirror because we're engineers.
Okay. Real good. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show. Very, very interesting to see and learn what it's all about and all the science behind it as well.
Great. Well, thank you for having us.
Real good. Okay, we're going to take a quick break right here. We're going to give a shout out to our good friends at Bridgestone. We'll be back to talk more of business and news and other things going on in the automotive industry.
Bridgestone is changing the game in tire performance.
So Ken Jeong can save gas on his trip to Vegas.
Remember, what happens in Vegas may haunt you forever. Okay, let's go.
These Bridgestone Ecopia Plus tires are fuel efficient and engineered to give you 20 extra miles per tank.
I usually stop here to fill up, but not today. Later, gas clowns! Was that too harsh? Because it felt great.
Coordinated our shirts, I see.
You're stealing my line.
Okay. Oh, sorry.
Okay, if you're just coming back and you just heard a different voice, that's because Bob Gritzinger from Ward's has joined us.
And I feel like I'm looking in a mirror.
But a full display mirror, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Great detail.
Nice shirt.
Nice.
How you doing?
Wonderful. Glad to be here.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah.
But now we go to a part of the program that's very important because it's time for Dr. Data.
All right, so John,
we got to get some music and you know some sort of flourish
prep
that brings
for
this
Dr.
in.
Data.
Yeah,
an adding machine.
Yeah, did it.
After you were in Beijing and talking about the air quality and the problems that. I've been looking.
Yeah, air and quality in Beijing are kind of oxymorons.
So right. I've been looking into things along those lines. So did you know that in London in 1952, from December 5th through 9th, you may remember this, Mark, that 12,000 people died because of what they called the big smoke. So there was an inversion.
Oh.
Okay, so there was cold air here, and then there was warm air above it, so it was keeping all the smog and fog down over the city. And because it was cold, they were burning coal for power, right? And so the Battersea Power Station, Bob would say, "Oh, the cover of the Pink Floyd album."
Exactly. Yeah.
And so they're burning all this coal, and so 12,000 people died. So, Carmen, the first slide, please.
Oh, yes, he has visuals.
Okay.
Okay.
So now we're looking at the UK. So this is in 2000, 14% of the vehicles were diesel powered. And in 2014, 50% of them were diesel powered. Okay.
So way more diesel vehicles today.
In the UK than
the
there
UK
were back
just 14 years ago, by your chart.
Yeah. And traditionally, the UK did not have lower taxes on diesel, which was why it was different from the rest of Europe.
Oh,
diesel was taxed at the same rate or a little bit higher than gasoline.
I did not know that.
Yeah, that's why
This is why we have you on the show.
Yeah.
That's why traditionally they were much lower diesel utilization than the rest of Europe.
Huh.
Mm. So they've obviously upped their game. And then presently nearly, and this is according to a study done by the Royal College of Physicians this year, that nearly all buses, vans, lorries, forms of water transport, and many trains, construction, and farm machinery also use diesel. So the obviously, these people are very sensitive to bad things happening since 1952 in terms of the smog. So
those that are around and remember it.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like you.
Like me. And Mark.
Carrie Ann.
So, Carmen, next slide, please. So they have done this study and calculated that 40,000 people per year are dying in the United Kingdom as a result of particulates in the air and the exposure to the oxides.
Oxides of nitrogen.
Yeah.
Wow.
Doesn't make you sort of want to breathe.
Actually, but that's from all sources.
Yes. So that would be the buses, the vans, the lorries,
right.
the watercraft,
I want to say,
the construction equipment.
In the United States, we know that there's roughly 33,000 to 35,000 people killed every year in motor vehicle accidents.
Right.
The number in the United States is about 35,000 people. Now, this is not all transportation. This is just
right, but this is
light vehicle.
This is breathing, right? So what you're talking about is traffic accidents are causing...
No. I'm saying that we know the number for traffic accidents. I'm saying the EPA has said in the United States 35,000 people die every year prematurely because of air pollution caused by light vehicles. So that's why I said
just
I think
like
the UK
vehicles,
number
not
sounds...
Not sources.
Pardon?
Sounds
just
a little
like
high.
Vehicles, not, you know, power
it's about the
everything.
Same. It's yeah. Almost as many people die from air pollution caused by cars right. as get killed in car accidents.
No, see, but realize if you have 50% of your light vehicle fleet is essentially diesel versus what do we have here, 2%, 1%, something like that?
Yeah.
There's a correlation, if not a causation, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But and if you look at the total United States, I want to say, I almost hate to quote it because I don't know the exact number, but let me safely say the EPA says from all sources of air pollution in the U.S., several hundred thousand people die every year prematurely.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's not like, you know, somebody fires up a coal plant and people fall down dead. It's an accumulation thing over time.
Yeah.
This is why we have air pollution laws. We know there's a direct correlation between not just health, but, you know, survivability.
Mm-hmm.
So you took a deep breath in China? Is that what
no,
you're saying?
No, I tried not to breathe at all.
Bring it all back with
it was
you.
Horrible. It was bad. I mean,
yeah,
it's...
Come back from there coughing for days. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So is that it, Dr. Data, or is there another one?
What's the number, 1952 or 40,000?
I leave it up to you, Bob.
I'm going 15.
15.
It went from 15% to 50%, from 20 to 15.
Diesel penetration.
So I'm going 15.
Yeah.
So I wonder what diesels will do in places like the UK as a result of what's going on with Volkswagen. Do you think they'll go down?
It's a really interesting. Plus, as gasoline engines adopt more of the same technologies, the difference, the fuel economy difference between the two fuels is getting smaller, and the difference in tax rates for diesels is being reduced. The benefit in lower taxes in Europe, they're raising the taxes. So, I mean, the trend line doesn't look great for diesels, even excluding the whole Volkswagen disaster.
You know, it's interesting you should mention that gasoline engines are becoming more diesel-like in certain characteristics. So the CX-9, which I was out driving last week, I don't know if you guys have had the opportunity.
The Mazda. Right?
Tom
the Mazda
Murphy CX-9. Was out there for us.
And so basically, you know, they've developed a new engine for that. It's a 2.5-liter engine, a 4, and they're replacing a 3.7 that was a 6.
Mm-hmm.
And Dave Coleman, who is an amazing engineering guy who works for Mazda, I think he's like one of the best.
Wow, he presents the information so well.
He's just a great guy. But he was talking about how when they were developing this engine, what they wanted to do was have the engine, they were concerned about real-world performance of the car versus what the window sticker would be for EPA fuel economy numbers or what the 0-60 time would be in ad. You know, they're saying that they wanted to have real world. And they thought for the 3-row crossover SUV, what would be more appropriate would be a lot of low-end torque because people are generally, you know, driving at lower speeds in those sorts of vehicles. And so what they did was they brought a CX-5, their smaller crossover, brought one over from Europe that had a diesel engine in it. And what they did was that they calibrated the diesel engine to have the sort of torque curve that they wanted to get from the engine that they were developing to see how it would perform, then loaded the CX-5 with weight to make it comparable to the CX-9, and have developed an engine that has more torque but less horsepower.
Diesel characteristic in a gas engine.
Deliberately. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Huh. So what'd you think of the CX-9?
I think that it is surprising to me that a company like Mazda, which is, as I checked last year, 1.8% of the U.S. market, has come out with such a phenomenal crossover vehicle. I mean, the thing is just great. I mean, and, you know, you look at that and say, why doesn't one of the bigger manufacturers come out with something that has, I mean, they looked at everything. I mean, first of all, the styling is just knockout gorgeous. I mean, again,
inside and out,
those guys have just done it. And then to the degree to which, you know, that they developed an all new engine for it. I mean, how the heck do they do this?
Well, also developed an all new all wheel drive for it. This predictive all wheel drive that I got to sample in the snow last winter, and it essentially, based on air temperature and before there is wheel slippage, it's sending power to the wheel
right.
that has traction.
Yeah, so what they're doing is they're basically saying, you know, we've got all kinds of sensors on vehicles for various and sundry things, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So we know, because we have sensors to cause the wipers to work,
yeah,
right?
That's part of it.
So we know if it's raining outside, right? Mm-hmm. Because if the wipers are going, chances are it's raining.
Right.
They have a temperature sensor to, you know, just know what the outside ambient temperature is. And so they say, okay, if it's below 32, there's a chance for ice. If these two things are combined, there's probably going to be wheel slipping.
Mm-hmm.
So the clever part is that they're taking all of this existing technology that they're using for other reasons and saying, how can we deploy this for our all-wheel drive? And this is one of the amazing things about this company is that, you know, you have these people who are just so damn clever and executing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
and across a whole range of vehicles as well.
Right.
You know, they're not giving up on small cars. No. They don't have a truck. So yeah.
Well, we had Robert Davis on the program, and I saw Robert out in San Francisco, and I was talking to him about our discussion about why they don't have a small pickup truck, and you know, I was talking to him about the Ridgeline, which we did last week, and I see you have out there right now.
Yeah.
And you know, Robert's still like, nope. No way, can't do it. Numbers don't add up. We're not going to be able to do that.
Well, you know, Mazda does an amazing amount of things for such a small company. Yeah. What do they sell globally? Like 1.5 million vehicles or something which these days is nothing.
Right. Yep.
But so they do a lot of really good stuff, but they can't do it all, you know?
Right.
That's why they don't have a hybrid. You know, they're going to rely on Toyota, I guess, to provide them the technology.
Well, but then the fuel efficiency that they're able to get by having this whole SkyActiv thing where you're looking at the engine, you're looking at the weight of everything.
Good aero.
Yep. Good aero, yeah.
Yep. Transmission development as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. And again, how does this stinky little company just...
My hope is that they still employ that little guy at Hiroshima with the hammer, who's on the end of the assembly line tapping little bolts, suspension bolts, under the vehicle. And when I was there, I asked, what's this guy doing? And they scurried around and discovered that he was checking for torque by sound.
Wow. Whoa.
Yeah.
I've never heard such a
thing. I was about 80 then, so I suspect he's still not there, but if he's alive, they should be employing him.
Either that or they...
It was art.
Either that or they said, oh, we got Gritzinger to believe it, too.
Yeah.
No. I've only reported it in venues like this.
I've never heard of such a thing.
Yeah, I couldn't figure out what... I thought, you know, it's Mazda. This isn't like GM in the 70s. They can't have him checking for, you know, somebody left a bolt in this door panel or somebody threw some screws in here. No, he was checking for torque. Amazing.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
So Google announced a few miles away from where we're sitting at this very moment that they're going to be opening a 53,000 square foot...
I brought Brent's story.
...facility. So... For their automated or their autonomous vehicle development, what do you guys think about that?
They need to be close to all those Pacificas that they're going to be working on.
You don't think Sergio would send them over?
Well, Pacifica hybrids and and they'll be building them here and be able to work together.
And there's more engineers here than any place else on Earth.
Yeah,
well, there's a lot in the valley, too.
There are, but I mean, if you just go, you know, number in, you know,
per capita, it's thicker here.
Yeah, and in a metro area, I mean, there's a ridiculous number of engineers and automotive engineers in particular here.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting to me because, you know, all this move to autonomy, mobility services, it's all been portrayed as the Valley versus Detroit. And now I think both sides are realizing, you know, Detroit needs the Valley and Valley needs Detroit. Mm-hmm. And sure, you know, Silicon Valley's got all these great software engineers. They're going to come up with all the algorithms. But at the end of the day, you got to implement them in a car. And you've got to put them through very specific duty cycles, test cycles. You've got to, you know, put them in salt baths. You got to have UV degradation, hot and cold testing over the Belgian blocks, up and down.
Software engineers don't even know what they don't know.
Right.
Right, yeah.
And well, so remember, even when Google built its first little bubble car, they didn't build it. They came to Livonia, Michigan, and had Roush Industries build it for them. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, what Google's... And look, who's running Google's autonomous car effort? John Krafcheck, who worked here in town for years at Ford and then went to Hyundai and then elsewhere, too. But he knows what it takes to develop a car. And I'm sure he's the first one who said, hey, guys, we got to put up operations in Detroit if we really want to bring this to market.
And I still am skeptical that they want to build large numbers of cars themselves. I still think that they're too smart not to realize there's more money to be made supplying that technology to every car company.
Exactly right. And that's another reason you come here if you're Google, because you got GM and Ford and FCA and Toyota and Nissan and Hyundai Kia, who all have big tech centers here. Big
Honda just down the road.
And Honda's not that far away, right? Yeah. So, and then you got all the suppliers from all over the world here. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm sure Krafcheck is the first one who said, hey, guys, let's set up shop there.
I sat in on this Startup Detroit event this week downtown, listened to Bill Ford Jr. Kick the thing off, and one of his points was, you know, it used to be there was Silicon Valley and there was Detroit, and they're seen as being at odds, and now they're starting to learn the strengths of each other and coming together. And so this is the first fruits of that, for sure.
Well, but then you also see, I mean, Ford put all that money into that cloud computing company a week or two ago, and we just had the announcement of Toyota
Uber thing,
A memorandum of understanding with Uber.
And Volkswagen would get.
We've got the General Motors spending an inordinate amount of money for Lyft.
Right.
Yep. So you see a lot of this development going on, and one of the things that I begin to wonder about is that who knew we need so many taxi drivers? I mean, think about that for a minute.
With autonomy, that may be a very short window of opportunity.
For those drivers?
Yeah. But here's the other thing, too, is as you get into this whole thing of mobility services, it starts to open up mobility to all segments of society, not just those who can qualify for a driver's license and keep it. And so I think it was... I'll think of it in a minute who did it. But one of the big research houses did a big deep dive into what happens when you open up mobility. And now many more elderly can use it. Young people can use it. Disabled people can use
it. People who can't see.
I mean, the vehicle miles traveled goes up by an astonishing rate. I mean, we're talking like a trillion miles a year or something like that. So
and the age restriction disappears.
Goes away.
Exactly. You put your 12-year-old in the autonomous car, and they go to the play
dance class to baseball practice or soccer.
And you know, companies like Uber are already, you know, delivering stuff, doing deliveries, meals, packages.
Right. Yeah.
Drones. You know, you say we never realized we needed so many taxi drivers, but once you start adding up how many miles more could get traveled every year, it's mind-blowing.
All right, so let me throw another set of numbers at you guys.
Okay.
All right. So you
can't repress Dr. Data.
So the University of Michigan Transportation Research Institute came out with a study that they did on the subject of autonomous vehicles and the way that people feel about autonomous vehicles. So here's their findings. 46% want full control. This mm-hmm. this whole autonomous thing is crazy.
Right.
39% want occasional control. 16% say, give me a full-on self-driving vehicle. I'm down with it. Of those who are not a part of that 16%, 95% want steering wheels and pedals, and 59% want sound vibration and visual warnings when they have to take over. Okay, so basically what this is finding is that people don't want autonomous vehicles. Now, is it that they don't want autonomous vehicles because they can't perceive what an autonomous vehicle is, or is it they just don't want them?
I think if you 100 years ago, more than 49% of people would have said they wanted a horse.
A faster horse.
Yeah. I think it's what do they understand.
Yeah, really. I think there's a real lack of understanding in what is
and what
all.
They trust.
There's surveys out there just this week on what people don't know is already in their car that's autonomous. Automatic forward collision braking or adaptive cruise control, lane keeping assist, all those kinds of things. Even just, you know, stability control wasn't there to the extent we see now 10 years ago, and people don't even know that that's happening.
Right.
And the beauty of it is the really good systems, they intervene and help these people all the time, and it's so imperceptible that they still don't know it's there.
Right. Yeah, so I think those numbers are a little...
No, I think those numbers accurately reflect what people think, but people have not been exposed to this technology at all. And if you had asked people in 1980, do you think you need a computer in your home? They would have gone, of course not. Yeah. A computer in my home? Yeah. What would I ever do with it?
Do you want your phone to take pictures?
Yeah. Right.
Do you need a phone with you all the time? Not at all. I can use a pay phone on the corner.
Exactly right. Yeah. And remember, the first smartphone came out 9 years ago. Only 9.
Really?
So and the first Google car, autonomous car, test car, only went on the road 4 years ago. So look how fast we've come in just 4 years from Google putting that technology on the road. So believe me, once people get in and experience this and see that it works, those numbers are going to change.
Right.
How does an automaker have the confidence that if they develop this technology that it will take off like a smartphone?
Look at the reaction to Google's autopilot or Tesla's autopilot. People are going nuts over this. In fact, some people are saying, this is why I don't want a Chevrolet Bolt EV and why I want a Model 3. I know I'm going to get autopilot in that.
But part of the answer to your question is, it won't take off like a smartphone. I mean, smartphones, they were on a meteoric pace. This will be slower, but... You know, people, one of the things, when I was driving Cadillac CT6 cross-country earlier this year, after the end of the drive, I realized all of the things that the autonomous features that are already in it had done that made the drive easier for me that I didn't even notice while they were happening. So I think people will get eased into it, you know, a step at a time.
And how long do you think it'll take before the total... autonomous car will
be? That's a great question.
Well, wait, let's come back to that. That's a great topic, but we got to take a quick commercial break right now. So, Carmen, let's give a shout-out to our friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back. So, continue the conversation.
So, when will full autonomous vehicles... I honestly have no idea. I mean, I think there will be a few that are capable of it within 6-7 years. When will there be widespread implementation of it? I really don't know.
What do you think, Gary?
First of all, we have the situation whereby you have a lot of existing vehicles, and it takes a long time for those vehicles to turn over. Mm-hmm. But I also think that it'll probably, I mean, if you look at the way that technology curves tend to work, that you have this acceleration, and I have a feeling that given processing power, memory, the cloud, take all of these factors, put them together, put in the fact that, you know, you have companies like General Motors that is saying, hey, you know, we're going to spend $500 million on a ride-hailing service. Why are they doing that? They're doing that to collect data. They're not doing that because they want to get the fares from these Lyft drivers. I mean, they're saying, you know, this is really valuable stuff that we need. I have a feeling that 5 years from now, it'll be an option. You go into your local dealer and say, well, there's the autonomous one. There's the electric one.
Or 5 years, it will be near, you know, that almost autonomous, sort of not fully autonomous, but semi-autonomous. What we're seeing now, but taken to, like, just the next step where you need to be aware of what's happening, but the car will drive you. Fully autonomous, to me, is sit back, read a book, watch a movie, let the car take you.
But if you don't have that, why would you even want to turn it on? That's the thing that I don't
quite get. Because, to Mark's point, you're driving cross country or you're driving in stop and go commuter traffic, and it takes all of the drudgery out of it.
Right.
You still have a car when you want to drive it, that where you can turn it all off. But for the downsides of, you know, that stop and go traffic or driving across Nebraska, you can let the car handle the work.
There goes the Nebraska audience.
Oh, well. I have friends there. I love Nebraska.
See, what it is that you turn on the autonomous part so you can admire the surroundings of Nebraska.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Yes.
That's
yes.
Right. See?
I think we're going to see autonomous cars within 2 years, not in showrooms. I think they're going to be in ride-sharing services. Uh-huh. I think they're going to be geofenced, i.e. they're not going to be able to go anywhere. Mm-hmm. They'll first be limited to speeds of 25 miles an hour, because then you don't have to meet any of the safety
Central
standards.
London.
Yeah, that would be a great place to go. But in the showroom, Tesla says it's going to be there 2020. And Tesla will push the envelope. They could do it. My guess is for major automakers, where the four of us could walk out today to any one of the local showrooms and buy one, probably looking more like 2025.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't think it'll come that fast?
I think it'll come much of 2020. Oh, 2025.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you meant 20 to 25 years from now.
No. I'm saying in
25 or 6 to 4.
In roughly 10 years, I'm saying... We'll be able to go out and buy an autonomous car.
I agree with that.
Yeah. Well, and people at GM say that the Super Cruise feature that they will have next year will basically be entrance ramp to exit ramp on the highway. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it will handle all the driving on the highway. That, for a lot of people, is functional autonomy.
I think Mercedes Distronic Plus will just about do that now.
Correct.
I've driven one from downtown Detroit out, you know, 30 miles out.
But you got to keep your hand on the bloody
wheel. Oh, yeah, because after 15 seconds, it tells you you need to get back on the wheel.
Right.
Jags, I have counted 45 seconds. Within an XF, 45 seconds around a curve, 70 miles an hour, my co-driver was a little troubled.
That's pretty good.
45 seconds.
Yeah.
So
we're getting there.
And just one little footnote to this that's sort of inside baseball, but I think it's significant that a buff book in our area has hired one of our colleagues as an autonomous vehicle reporter.
Really?
Yeah. So
what's this going to do to the buff books, man?
Well, they're scared to death of it. I mean, I think, you know, if your whole idea of how you tell consumers the value of a car is based on skid pad numbers, you're a dinosaur.
But isn't it pretty much like, I don't know, readers of yachting? I mean, people still have yachts, right? And they probably still enjoy
people
their yachts.
People still sail. People still ride horses.
So the thing of it is that it comes down to the fact that by and large, the McLarens and the Ferraris and the whatevers, they'll still be covered by those. And skid pads will be very important to those people.
Yeah, but it sure shrinks your audience your reason for being.
Or you, stamp collecting
or
magazines.
Or you gain audience because they're watching reviews
they're
of the cars.
They're
reading your publication while they're riding in their car.
Equestrian magazines, you know, just think what happened. Look at the damn car did to those horse magazines.
But, Mark, talk about what you think. You're the car critic for the Detroit Free Press. I got to believe, in an autonomous world, the way that you critique or evaluate a vehicle is going to be quite different
than
you do
today. It already is, though. My philosophy is anything that the car company charges for, they are responsible for delivering well. So I spend as much time figuring out how is the voice recognition as I do getting used to what the on-center feel of the steering is. Mm-hmm. All of it matters, and it matters. It's like anything else. The things that matter to a Corvette buyer are different from the things that matter to a minivan buyer, and you got to figure out what is it. But no, I think I was just driving a wonderful car that was great fun, and it had a terrible execution of Apple CarPlay, and that significantly reduced my enjoyment of that car.
The Audi A4, he ripped it into his face.
Right. See, you can run, but you can't hide on this show.
All right, so, okay, I found something this week that I
know where you're going. I want to hear this.
I don't know if you know where I'm going. But
Do I have to take notes? I'm going to take notes. Go ahead.
You can take notes. Okay, so autonomous cars. So this really surprised me that this organization was in favor, is pushing autonomous vehicles. They want a national effort to be made to push autonomous vehicles. And they came out with a report, 166 pages worth of report.
Did you read
report,
the whole thing?
Most of it. A national strategy for energy security. Okay. Now, this is the co-chair of this is Fred Smith, who was the founder and current CEO of FedEx. And there's a list of the people who are on this council. And I won't bore you all with all of these people that are on there. But many of these people are military guys.
Okay.
Okay. And so basically, all that cheap gas that we have right now, these guys are making the argument that basically that is the Saudis gaming the system, okay? So they write in their report, OPEC is working to undermine the American shale industry. So what they're making the argument is that that we had all of this development that was going on.
Yeah, you don't need a 166-page report. I think that was on Fox or something like 3 months ago. Yeah.
So basically they're saying that U.S. households in 2015 enjoyed a $94.6 billion windfall from less money being spent on gasoline. But they're pretty much convinced that, in Carmen, the picture that I thought looked like came from the 1930s, there we go. 1973, OPEC oil embargo. People lined up to get gasoline.
I'm in that car there. Yeah. No, maybe that's you, Jan.
Yeah. Yeah, long line of cars waiting to get gas.
So it's very interesting. So these guys are basically saying that as soon as 2018, we may have a shortfall of petroleum products.
It'll be short-lived, though. Part of what's going on right now is that there's a little bit of a downturn in China as well. But if there's a short-term prices, a shortfall, prices go up again, and it becomes economical to pump and explore for more shale oil. Mm-hmm. So, I think you're right. I think they are trying to undercut some of the development.
But I would add, the Saudis are in danger of bankrupting themselves in pursuing a policy like this. Well, they are spending money like crazy and burning up all their cash reserves.
The Iranians have come online with, now flooding the market.
And Saudi Arabia is selling Aramco. If they thought oil was the place to be in the future, they would not be looking for foreign investments in the national oil company for the first time in their history.
And remember, Gary, we had that great show in New York where we're talking about electric vehicles. And there's a study from Bloomberg Energy Investment, I think is the name of the operation. And they're predicting that around 2023 is when sales of electric cars, plug-ins, really start to take off. And they're projecting that before the next decade is out, we're going to face another oil glut because these cars are not going to be running on oil. So
right. Sure.
I don't know. To me, this is I don't buy the strategy or the worry that the Saudis are gaming the system and that we better be worried about.
I'm sure they're gaming it, but I think to your point, it's not going to work because, as soon, like Mark says, as soon as the prices go up, it becomes profitable.
You uncap those wells that got capped,
and you're back in business.
North Dakota becomes a boom state again. Yeah. But what you, the point you started to make about autonomy, though, and that I think is really well made, because I think those defense people were saying that autonomous vehicles will reduce fuel consumption, mm-hmm. and that's really smart. And it's another one of the big benefits we're going to get. I mean, we're already seeing, you know, cars that have got navigation systems that are linked to GPS, so they understand, you know, how to feather the throttle if they're going up or down a hill. And when you've got a significant part of all of the cars on the road that are networked, and the most efficient way to get where they're going is part of it, that has to have a huge effect on
Mm-hmm. Well, isn't the military already testing platooning with the supply trucks,
they are,
I thought?
Yes.
And so, you know, and that takes out personnel. It, you know, when you're in a dangerous area, you don't have to send as many people in, and the supplies all get to where they need to go. In one big train.
So these guys are basically, I mean, they want energy independence, and they're concerned mm-hmm. that as we say, hey, you know, why bother doing the oil sands? Why should, you know, which is yeah. a very expensive thing to do. Right. Why should we do deep water drilling? Very expensive thing to do. So they're saying on the order of $225 billion have been taken out of
the industry.
Development, okay. capital investment, and so on by the oil companies, because we're all going, damn, get all this cheap gas. This is
yeah,
great.
Well, you know, clearly these are not stupid people. So, and, you know, they really believe strongly about it to put out a report like this. So maybe I got to go and read more of it. But on the surface of it, I just don't buy their argument. Yeah, there will be disruptions, but I don't see us getting crippled.
Well, but I mean, what they're saying is that why don't we just do some simple things like, for example, in California, you know, we've talked about the carpool stickers, you know, that maybe what you need to do is to incentivize people in a non-financial way, but allow them to be in the carpool lane, more of them. They're saying that if you look at the tax credits that people get for buying alternative fuel vehicles right now, if a car company sells more than 200,000,
then it goes away. Yeah.
Goes away. And they're saying, well, maybe what you need to do is to lift that limit. Now, at a certain point, and they're suggesting maybe between 2021 and 2023, that you begin to phase that out, because perhaps by that point in time, people have bought a sufficient number of these things whereby it won't be a problem. You know, they're saying they'd like to have more tax credits in R&D for developing batteries and for developing better tanks for natural
Gary,
gas.
You are talking, you know, you're walking down the road here to a national energy policy.
Oh, don't talk crazy now, man.
Oh, I know. That's crazy talk. I mean, that's socialism.
Well, and they're also saying that the government buys and has more than 400,000, and this, I love this because there were a lot of military guys in this thing, yeah. non-tactical vehicles. Those would be sedans, I think, yeah. right? And so they're saying, okay, and they also spend $1.2 billion a year on fuel for those non-tactical vehicles. So they're saying, maybe what the government ought to do is buy more alternative fuel vehicles to kickstart.
Well, you know, there's a good argument in that. You know, one of the reasons why oil prices are so volatile and why they can go up so much is oil has no competition.
Yeah.
You know, imagine if you said, oh, you mean I can't buy gasoline? No worries. I'll just get this electric. I'll get this fuel cell or whatever it happens to be, maybe biofuel at some point, too. But that's what we need to do. Is present the oil companies or the oil industry with a lot more competition because they've had a monopoly for a century.
Mm-hmm.
And now they produce most of the hydrogen as well. So, you know,
they love hydrogen.
They look at fuel cells and they think, come on.
Yeah.
For us.
Yeah. No, they hate ethanol, but they love hydrogen.
Yeah.
I was thinking about that picture with all those people who were lined up for those pumps.
Yeah.
If they were autonomous vehicles, you know, people could read books while they were... Or listen to the show on Stitcher.
There you go.
But you can listen to the show on Stitcher while driving, too.
Yeah, but they,
we don't want to tell people not to do that.
But that's right.
Yeah. But they could applaud. Okay.
Yeah.
So when you said something that was cogent and thoughtful, that they'd...
I feel bad about how many accidents I caused by saying brilliant things. Yeah.
Indianapolis 500 this weekend.
Well, I was going to say that's the segue from saying alternative fuels, right? Because they all run on ethanol. So, yeah, I'm going to the 100th running of the Indy 500 this weekend.
It's
historic. They sold the whole place out, and I don't think
really?
I'm not sure they've ever done
You've
that.
You've been there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there. I mean, there's nothing quite like being in that infield and watching those stands fill up over the course of a morning. It is the greatest.
So Bob, were you saying you were in the snake pit and you were watching?
Oh, I was. I've several times been out there in the infield and, you know, well, woke up in the infield.
Gained consciousness.
Where the hell am I? Right, yeah.
But the place is sold out, you were saying?
That's what they said.
That's great.
So, yeah, they, you know, the grandstand sold out, I guess, several weeks ago. And then they just announced, I think yesterday, that all the general admission tickets are sold, too.
So you
might be able to go down and get something from a scalper, but...
So you're leaving right after the show to...
No, tomorrow morning.
Get in there?
Tomorrow morning, yeah.
Yeah, you want to leave early to beat the traffic.
Is it still the greatest spectacle in racing?
I've never been that big a fan, frankly. But it's a great event, and I would like to see other people go to it and keep it alive.
Yeah.
What do you think, Bob?
I, having been there in the middle of it, it's insane. The size, the sheer size is amazing. And I've been to Daytona. I've driven on Daytona. And, you know, the size and intensity of it all. And when the race is close, as they have been at times, you know, a 2/10 of a second between first and second, nothing quite like it.
Yeah. It's...
And I'm a Formula One fan, too. Yeah. So, you know, I say that. Yeah, so...
Right, no, I'm an F1 fan, too. But, yeah, Indy is unique. It probably is.
And Indy actually has passing, unlike most Formula One races.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
right. But, you know, Le Mans is a great race, too. It's spectacular. But Indy, to your point, Bob, when you're in the infield, or even anywhere. More impressive, in the bleachers, or the, you know, the stands, I should say, the sheer number of people, there's going to be something like 400,000 people there.
Yeah.
And, you know... You've never been anywhere else where there's 400,000 people, I assure
murmur,
you.
Just the murmur of that crowd at 11 in the morning.
And there's this pageantry and tradition and, you know, and all races do that sort of thing. But at Indy, you know, it's the 100th running. No other race has ever been as long as Indy. You know, some people have said, oh, no, Pikes Peak is older. I looked it up. No, the first Pikes Peak race was 5 years after the first 500.
Yeah, they paved that deal. So,
yeah, right. You know. So, yeah, and I was at last year's race, and I don't even think it was 2/10 of a second. I think it was more like 200ths of a second. And what was great, it was Montoya and Will Power and Dixon was in there. And the roar of the crowd, every time one of them would make a pass, drowned out all the engines. And I was with some German guys who had come over, and they were like, whoa! They had never seen anything like it before. And they're all big F1 fans.
Right, and they go to soccer games there where the crowd gets really loud. So... You know, and big crowds, so it's unbelievable kind of event. Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to it. Should be a lot of fun.
Taking us with you, huh?
Vicariously, yes.
Okay, good.
Yeah. I'll keep you in mind as I'm enjoying
just
myself.
Just periscope the whole thing back to us. How about that?
Right. There you go.
Well, actually, this will be one of the third time that it's going to be shown live on television in Indiana.
Yeah. They lifted the blackout.
Really? Yeah. Wow.
Because no one can buy tickets because it's sold out.
Oh, so it's like a Lions game from a couple decades ago, right?
That's
right. Silverdome years.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, they'd lift the blackout.
Yeah.
Real good. Well, we ought to wrap up here. So, Bob Gritzner, thanks so much for coming by.
Pleasure. Let's do it again.
We will do it again.
All right.
Mark Phelan, great having you here.
Thank you.
And Gary, let's do it again next week.
Next week.
Real good. And we invite all of you to join us then.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with AutoLine Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.